This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps. Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This episode, we'll be discussing all things social anxiety. And our guest is joining us from the US via the wonders of Skype. Before we get into that, I've got a few stats I'd like to start off with. We'll start off with the stats from the US, and these are from socialphobia.org, who found the latest government epidemiological data show social anxiety affects around 7% of the population at any given time. The lifetime prevalence rate, so that's, in other words, the chance of developing social anxiety disorder at any time during a person's lifespan, was found to stand at slightly above 13%. And straight away, those two stats, 13% lifetime prevalence versus 7% prevalence at any one time, is quite striking to me, that that's essentially over half of the people that will ever experience social anxiety are experiencing it right now. And I think that's very in contrast to what a hidden mental health condition this can be. And I think that very much lends itself to the way it takes root, in that people with social anxiety put so much time and thought towards coming across normal and maybe reducing attention they bring to themselves. That then, as a byproduct, means the condition can be very hidden. Yeah, so that's my initial thoughts on those stats, really. And for the UK, it's similar sort of levels. So this is from nice.org.uk. Estimates of lifetime prevalence vary, but they have been as high as 12%. Compared with estimates for other anxiety disorders of around 6% for generalized anxiety disorder and 5% for panic disorder. And again, there, I think it shows how this is a lot more common than many people realize. General anxiety disorder seems to often be pitched as the sort of the default and the biggest anxiety condition, whereas these stats, whether they're from the US or the UK, tell a very different story. And so, just so we're all on the same page, he says, turning his page, I've got a definition for social anxiety disorder as well, just so we all know how it's differentiated from other anxiety disorders. So this is from the NHS. Social anxiety disorder, also called social phobia, is my understanding that it's not called that anymore, but some people still refer to it as that, is a long-standing and overwhelming fear of social situations. It's a common problem that usually starts during the teenage years. For some people, it gets better as they get older, although for many, it doesn't go away on its own. I think that's very reflected in the interview as well, when we talk about what sort of ages this comes on, and how for most people, it's not something you grow out of. It's something where you need the support, and you should absolutely reach out and get that if you need it. And the final thing I wanted to mention from my research here is just in terms of how this can really affect everyone. So even the people that you see in the media that seem very extroverted and very comfortable being out there and being social can still be affected by this. And that's something we really try and represent in our social media as well. So this, I've got a quote here, we'll probably add to our Instagram quotes. And that's from Sia. So obviously she's a really well-known international pop star, but she still deals with social anxiety. So her quote is, "I have social anxiety. It's easier up on stage because there's security in being there. When I'm off stage, I'm trying not to be a manic freak. I'm quite shy." And so Sia is someone I really love. So that one really resonated with me, of even someone so in the public eye still is dealing with these things behind the scenes. In a moment, we'll get into our interview, and that's with Ellen Hendrickson. She's a fellow podcast host And she's also recently written a book, and we'll discuss both of those in the episode. But first,
this week's Audible recommendation.
This week, I'm recommending Pao by Kerry Young. That's spelled P-A-O, and it's the name of the main character. This book is an incredible life story, really. It is a novel, but she tells stories in a way that the characters seem so real. And the following two books in the series are from the perspective of different main characters. So you start to see situations from a completely different light. It's such a fascinating read. I think as you read it, it won't surprise you that she studied philosophy. I was lucky enough to be tutored by this writer a number of years ago. So yeah, I really love this book. If you think you will too, then you can try it for free with Audible. You'll need the link bit.ly/mentalbooks, and the details are also in the description.
My name is Dr. Ellen Hendrickson. I'm a clinical psychologist in Boston in the United States, and I specialize in anxiety. I work at the Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders at Boston University. I've been there for about 3 years, and I've come to anxiety in a kind of roundabout way, and I also have a background in it myself. When I was in graduate school and studying about social anxiety in particular, mm-hmm. I recognized a lot of myself in the symptoms. I recognized a lot of the experiences, and in learning how to treat it, really was able to make some giant steps forward myself. And it was so useful and just so helpful to undo some of the beliefs that I had. I wish I had known when I was 20 that how I felt wasn't how I looked, that I didn't wear my anxiety on my sleeve. I wish I had known that the things I was doing to try to make myself feel better, like avoid eye contact or be overly nice so people would like me, I wish I had known that those things were just keeping me anxious. I wish I had known that all the things I avoided were not nearly as bad as my imagination thought they were going to be. Or finally, that my perfectionism, so like thinking I had to come across as witty or smart or carry all of the conversation or, you know, at least not sound like a loser. I wish I had known that those beliefs was making me not say anything. Mm-hmm. And so as a result of kind of going through my own revelations and helping other people work with their own anxiety and specifically social anxiety, I really developed just a special place in my heart for social anxiety. And a few years ago, was able to make a dream come true and wrote a book called How to Be Yourself, okay. Quiet Your Inner Critic and Rise Above Social Anxiety.
Great. Okay, so we'll backtrack a little bit there. So when you talked about studying, mm-hmm. So I studied psychology, although at a much lower level, A level, which sure. is the final qualification of secondary school in the UK. Mm-hmm. And I can really relate to that. I had this similar thing of I was reading all about various mental illnesses, various, and not even just that, just how our brain works. And so much of it resonated with me. And I think that was the first time that I really understood how our minds are a lot more universal than I thought they were. I spent a long time thinking, oh, it's just me that thinks this way. Mm-hmm. And that's something that really fascinates me about psychology. So it's interesting to know you had a similar experience. So was there any particular like symptoms, as it were, that most resonated with you at that point?
Well, I had realized kind of after the fact that little things just added up. Like I'd say, you know, years ago, my wardrobe consisted pretty much of like black, white, and denim, things mm-hmm. that would make me blend in to the point where I would almost disappear. I wouldn't wear shoes that click-clacked on the floor because I thought they drew too much attention. I would go to parties and gatherings. So I would show up. I wouldn't do what's called overt avoidance. Mm-hmm. But I would engage in what is called covert avoidance, where I would talk only to the people I came with and was comfortable with. I would avoid eye contact with anyone I didn't know. I would just kind of keep my head down and do my thing and wait to get out of there. And so there was a kind of a white knuckling through social events that I didn't realize wasn't typical, mm-hmm. and that it didn't have to be that way. And so in kind of learning how to mitigate social anxiety, learning how to treat social anxiety in others, like I said, I really learned how to treat myself as well. And that was huge. Mm-hmm. And I think it's helpful in having some credibility and being able to say, I've been there. I know I'm not in your shoes. Your shoes are unique. You have mm-hmm. your own journey and your own reasons that you came to these challenges, but I get it at the same time. Yeah. So I find that it's been really helpful to be able to relate to so many people. And there are so many of us that have challenges with social anxiety.
Absolutely. And I'll put some stats in the top of the episode as well. But mm-hmm. in terms of social anxiety in particular, I think it is so much more common than people realize. And actually, it's one of those things in mental health in general that it's hard to understand a lot of mental health conditions unless you understand some of the more common ones like anxiety and depression, because they can so often be symptoms of other conditions, or there can so often be overlap. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. If there was a Venn diagram of different, you know, diagnosable disorders, there would be multiple others overlapping with social anxiety. Folks with social anxiety, sometimes it can stand alone, absolutely, mm-hmm. but there is very frequently overlap with depression. Folks tend to worry themselves into a depression. There is frequently overlap with panic. Some people will panic before a social event or an event where they are afraid they're going to be judged and revealed as being somehow deficient. And therefore not go, which takes away the opportunity to learn that it wasn't as bad as we thought or that we could handle it. And there, especially among men, is a huge overlap with alcohol use mm-hmm. and misuse. And so, and you know, by all means, those are not the only overlaps, but yeah, that social anxiety has many, many tentacles that get into lots of different areas of mental illness. So yeah. Absolutely.
For sure. And it's interesting hearing about how you didn't realize how many of these things you had, or you maybe thought that they were normal before you realized you had social anxiety and found out more about that. I think that's quite common.
Whatever we grow up with, it for us is normal. I've, you know, as an extreme example, I've had, you know, people come to me, you know, who have had horrific childhood abuse experiences, but think that was normal. They think that is how all children grow up. Mm-hmm. And so I think for, you know, along the entire continuum of childhood experiences and growing up, you know, whatever we are in is our reality. And so we tend to think that whatever that is typical, and that this is how life is and how things are.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think people can build up a certain comfort in that, because mm-hmm. Particularly with something like anxiety, if you have coping methods, whether they're healthy or not, so for example, alcoholism, of course, isn't. Because it's something that you use as a crutch in a way to cope with your anxiety, it can be something that I've seen people really start to cling to. So then when they're sort of aware of, oh, this is, they drill down and they realize some of the reasons they're really drinking, they can still be reluctant to let go of it because that's what they know. That's their coping mechanism. As you say, that's their reality on how to fix it.
Absolutely. And especially with social anxiety, there is research showing that, I'm using this word, you know, in quotes, that alcohol, you know, works short term mm-hmm. to reduce it. For every drink, it's been shown that social anxiety reduces by 4%. And so it makes sense. It's reinforcing where if someone will have a drink and feel better and have another drink and feel better, it that's very powerful. That that reinforcement can be very powerful. Mm-hmm. And so it makes sense that people go back to that because, again, short term it works. Long term, absolutely, it does not, because it prevents that learning that we can handle things and that the worst case scenario doesn't happen. Those are the two main lies that social anxiety tells us, that the worst case is bound to happen. We will be revealed as deficient and therefore be rejected or humiliated. And so that's one. The second lie that social anxiety tells us is that we are just ill-equipped to handle what life throws at us, and we are incapable. We cannot do it. And so when we stretch and grow and try just to push ourselves a little bit, then that's where the learning occurs, and that's where we realize that we are stronger and more capable than we thought, and also that the world is friendlier and more accepting than we thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one of those things where, depending on, I think, how bad you are with any form of anxiety, you need to make that conscious effort, because the alternative is you have that constant voice in your head. And although some people, their anxiety can reduce with age and things like that, for most cases that I've known of, personally, people have had to take action, because otherwise the voice in their head never stops. It's mm-hmm. always going to be there telling you about the worst case scenarios. And when it's that relentless, it can be hard to push away from it. So in terms of coping mechanisms you had then, were there any things you noticed in yourself that this is quite an unhealthy way of coping?
If I was with people who were either strangers to me or acquaintances, I would focus inward, and my attention would naturally turn inward, and I would monitor how things were going mm-hmm. and think, okay, what is what I'm about to say? Does this sound okay? Or why did I just say that? That was so stupid. And my attention would focus on me. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, I would not have very much bandwidth left to experience the moment I was in and to actually pay attention and be present mm-hmm. In whatever social situation was happening around me. And so I realized that there were many things that I actually couldn't remember when somebody would say to me, oh, remember we went to that restaurant after the football game, or remember we did that thing. I actually wouldn't remember because mm-hmm. I wasn't present for it. And so that was something that built up over time and kind of made me realize, oh, this is not how I want to be going through my life. And so with that was one of the things that I realized almost in hindsight that was happening.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And the way you describe it, it comes across as a very logical way of coping. But I've seen myself how even when you take that logic, it can still kind of backfire on you. Mm-hmm. For example, a friend of mine who is dealing with generalized anxiety disorder, he would do that where he'd think through everything he was going to say to the point where he'd persuade himself not to say most things because he'd convince himself he was going to sound stupid. And so it ended up getting so bad that most of the time when he'd contribute to a group conversation, it would be to say something negative about someone the group disliked. Because that way he had that confirmation from how other people talk about those people that was acceptable, that these were acceptable things to say. But it meant that actually, although he was agreeing with everyone and that on the face of it seems he would be liked, he came off as very negative. And so actually people started to pick up on that and react badly to it.
Yeah, that's one of the tragic paradoxes of social anxiety, is that the very things that we do to try to keep ourselves safe, and this actually has a term, it's called safety behaviors. Mm-hmm. So anything we do to try to artificially tamp down or neutralize our anxiety often comes off not as we intend. So, for example, I'm working with a gentleman currently who I obviously will not name, is not so much worried about coming across as stupid, but is worried about coming across as a burden. And so he mm-hmm. will not stop and chit-chat with neighbors or coworkers or people that he sees because he's worried about intruding upon their time or invading their privacy. And so he ends up not chatting and not connecting. And but as a result of keeping people at arm's length, theoretically to be respectful and to be very aware of their space and their needs, he comes off as cold and comes off as if he doesn't like them and comes off as disrespectful. It's the exact opposite of what he intends. And so that happens with many of the safety behavior strategies. If we scroll through our phone at a party to quash those feelings of awkwardness, again, it broadcasts this sense that we are standoffish and cold. And when really we're just anxious. And so there's this, again, this paradox where the things we do to try to protect ourselves leave us isolated. And so that's something to try to drop, those safety behaviors and see what happens. Mm-hmm. See what, if we can indeed connect with others.
Yeah, because in situations like that, it becomes such a cruel irony that actually that gentleman was spending so much time thinking about being a burden to everyone else, whereas actually he was his own self-saboteur, that he was the one that was most affecting his interactions with people, not anyone else's perception, his own perception and the things going on inside his head, telling him he was a burden.
Right. And so what we did and what he started working on was to turn the tables and to think, well, when somebody starts a conversation with me or if somebody chit-chats with me at work, do I find that to be a burden? Do I find that to be annoying? And in 99% of the time, the answer was no. I'm glad this person started this conversation. I was happy to have this connection. I enjoyed talking to this person. And so that gave him permission to start doing that. And it really helped turn things around for him.
That's really great. And so out of interest with situations like that, could you say roughly what proportion of situations is it where someone's anticipating problems that they've never actually had evidence for, or is that often like a root cause? Has someone had a bad experience and that's brought on anxiety?
That's a great question. So there is a huge overlap with all those different reasons. So social anxiety is genetic, and if you have a first degree relative, so a parent, a sibling, a child with social anxiety, you also have a 4 to 6-fold increased chance of having that same disorder, so social anxiety, yourself. So that's one. So there's a genetic factor. About 30%, I've seen this in the literature, percent of social anxiety cases are the result of bullying or other kind of childhood, adolescent, there are adult bullies, so any time during the lifespan, bullying. So that's a systematic bullying of an individual can absolutely result in social anxiety because that teaches your brain that people are not safe and you will be rejected or you will be humiliated just for existing and that there is something wrong with you. Let me take a step back and say that social anxiety is based on a distortion, so like a cognitive error, that there is something wrong or deficient about us. And unless we work really hard to conceal whatever we think that is, whatever that deficiency we perceive, we will be revealed, we will be judged and rejected for our deficiency. And so that's why we work so hard to try to keep ourselves invisible or safe or hidden. But that perception is exactly that, a perception. It's either not true or perhaps noticeable to a tiny degree, but not so much that anyone notices or cares.
I just want to pause on bullying there for a moment. I think it's important to mention that really whatever the age of the recipient of bullying is, that's how the bully really wins. If the things that they tell you, you then internalize that, then they're inside your own mind telling you all these negative things. And that's how they really win, because otherwise you move on. There'll be a time when they're not there. You still, I think, have a choice to a certain extent of whether or not you let them in. And for someone with anxiety, maybe that's getting support elsewhere. That's not just something you can achieve on your own. But I just wanted to mention that there as well. Would you agree with that?
I would. I think when you're in it, when you are being bullied, it can be really hard not mm-hmm. to let the bully in. Because I think, especially for folks who are more sensitive, the bullies unfortunately target those individuals. But after the fact is when you can really do the work and undo the damage that the bully has done. Mm-hmm. And moving on is the best thing one can do, to realize that whatever one is internalized is not true, that the bully was the one who was behaving inappropriately.
I agree. And you were going to go back to my question.
Sure. Yeah, no, so you asked about, you know, where social anxiety comes from. And so I say in genetics, or like a discrete experience of, you know, of bullying or some other kind of social trauma. Sometimes it is simply modeling, like we might grow up in a family that just simply never socializes mm-hmm. or keeps to themselves, or we might have grown up in a very isolated area where there just wasn't much opportunity to practice socializing. And so our skills are rusty, and we don't have a lot of confidence in what we're supposed to do, and therefore feel like that something is wrong with us. So it can have many different seeds, many different roots, but it all does kind of grow into the same flower of believing there is something deficient about us, and that will be revealed unless we work hard to hide it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and another question to add on to that one, is there a particular time when people generally get help or diagnosis of social anxiety?
So social anxiety generally starts, when you ask people to trace it back, mm-hmm. it generally starts between ages 8 and 15. So, you know, tween years, early adolescence. However, at least in my experience, people don't come in for help until, and again, this is not scientific. I don't know the studies on this, but just in our practice, in our clinic, usually during the university years, I see a lot of people between the ages of 18 and 25. And then I also see a lot of people who are midlife, like 40s, kind of mid-career, and they come in because they are at a point in either their work life or their home life where they are having the opportunity to either like move ahead in their career. They've been offered a promotion. Now they have to travel more, or speak more, or give presentations, and they're having a really hard time doing that. Or they might go through a divorce and have to start dating again, and are terrified to do that. And so I found, at least again anecdotally, the two times that people generally come in for treatment are university years or midlife. But people can come in at any time, absolutely. And then there's lots we can do when they do come in, which is so hopeful. And mm-hmm. and although social anxiety can be one of the more debilitating anxiety disorders, it's also one of the most treatable, which is very hopeful and good news for everyone. Yeah.
Okay. And so kind of leading into that then, to put you on the spot, for this topic in particular, are there any maybe three tips that you'd say you've noticed have helped people or help yourself most in dealing with social anxiety?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first, so I was talking, I guess, before about attention and how in a social situation, attention naturally turns inward and we go into this mode of self-monitoring and impression management. And so the first thing that that we do in treatment is to teach people to turn their attention inside out and to focus outward and listen to the person they're talking to look at them and the environment around them, and to just basically, you know, turn their attention inside out like a sock.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of focusing on oneself, to focus on the environment, and that can help the anxiety. We can help, that can help turn the volume down on the anxiety. A nice exercise that I have folks do is I ask them to, for homework, to go out and engage in two separate conversations. It could be with a colleague, could be with just a clerk at a store. But in the first conversation, to turn our attention inward and focus on what they're going to say, to monitor, to review what they just said, to focus on their body and how they are standing and holding their limbs and their facial expression, to really, really do that, engage in that impression management and that self-monitoring, and then see how they feel. And then in the second conversation, to practice turning their attention outward, to look at the person they're talking to, listen closely to what is being said, and to essentially focus on anything except themselves. Mm-hmm. And then after that experience, to compare the two and see which was more pleasant, which was more productive, in which did they feel less anxious. And inevitably, in the second, where they turned their attention outward, they felt better. And so that stark contrast can drive them forward and really kind of sell the benefits. So that's one thing.
Yeah, I really like that one. And it's a great way of comparing in your own mind how you're perceiving situations and someone that I might describe as cognitively standard is experiencing those same situations. So I really love that one. Go ahead. Next one, please.
Yeah, and I guess just to follow up with that, I want just to set expectations. It's not as if the anxiety will vanish magically, mm-hmm. But it's as if the anxiety, the inner critic in our heads, is I liken it to kind of a loud radio in the background. It's kind of this distracting chatter that's happening. So turning one's attention inside out will not, especially at the beginning, will not necessarily turn off that radio, but it will turn down the volume. And that can be very rewarding.
It can
Exactly. And the more they do it, the lower that volume will get until eventually it will disappear. The second technique or tool is to give yourself some structure. And by that, I mean to give yourself a goal or a purpose in a conversation or a social event, because the driver of anxiety, of all anxiety, is uncertainty. It's not knowing what's going to happen next. It's not knowing if we're going to be safe. It's the not knowing. And so if we can give ourselves an assignment or some structure, that takes away that uncertainty and makes us feel more comfortable. So, for example, we could go into a holiday party and say, okay, I'm going to talk to three people I've never met. Or we can walk into a networking session and decide that we're going to try to exchange business information with two new people. We could decide we're going to try to get to know somebody as well as we can in 5 minutes, which is exactly what happened in a study that I love to cite. These are two Australian researchers, doctors Ron Rapay and Simon Thompson. And what they did is they designed this really ingenious experiment that took women from the top and bottom of the social anxiety continuum. So each of these women, one at a time, walked into this waiting room, ostensibly for the experiment, which, unknown to them, began as soon as they walked into the waiting room. And so they had a seat, and then a lab assistant, a research confederate, would walk in after them, have a seat, and make the comment of, hope we don't have to wait too long. And then he was always a male lab assistant, would wait for 30 seconds. And every 30 seconds for 5 minutes, if conversation had not ensued or had fizzled, he would make another comment, like a little conversational prompt, mm-hmm. and see what happened. Okay, so after 5 minutes, then a researcher came in and said, okay, thank you guys for coming, really appreciate it. Here's what we'll do for the experiment. I want you to pretend that you're at a party and get to know each other as well as you can in the next 5 minutes. Go. And then conversation ensued. But this time, each of these women had an assignment. They had some structure and they knew what to do. Mm-hmm. And in the end, when these 2 5-minute increments were compared, in the first 5-minute increment where there was no structure, it was just the comments like dropped, almost out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. There was a significant gap in terms of, like, let's call it social performance. And then in the second 5 minutes, when there was structure, when there was an assignment, the two groups were
pretty much neck and neck. It wasn't exact, but the women with social anxiety performed almost as well as the women who had no social anxiety. And that's astounding to me, that it's not that we don't have the skills. It's not that we don't have we don't have it in us. It's that the anxiety is getting in the way of letting those skills shine and come out.
And it's interesting how something as small as someone else giving you an instruction is enough to just reframe that whole situation for you, because then your social anxiety would sort of flip, I imagine, to being like, oh, well, now I need to do this because I've been given a task. I can't fail the task.
True. That's a nice segue in that perfectionism is a huge driver of social anxiety. Mm-hmm. And we think that unless we are witty and carry the conversation and are well-liked by everyone, then we failed. And so it's important to try to kind of reel back those expectations and to remember that it's okay to say, it's okay to lose your train of thought. It's okay to say something stupid. It's okay to crack a bad joke. Mm-hmm. And that is part of being human.
Yeah.
And everybody has those awkward moments. And that's part of that's part of the human condition and brings us together. Everyone can relate to that.
Well, exactly. And your friends all do those things and yet you still like them.
Yes. Yes. I'm glad you said that. Yes. So I guess the last tip I would give is to challenge folks to not, you know, they don't have to jump into the pool at the deep end, but to do the things that they are a little bit afraid of. So I often have people come into the office and say, okay, I'm here because I want to build my confidence. I want to gain skills. I want to kind of press pause on my life and do this work and then go out and live my life. And I say, that's awesome. I'm glad you're motivated. Fantastic. Glad you're here. And let's do that in the other order. Let's have you live your life in order to gain the confidence, because that is how confidence works. We have to put behavior before our attitude. We can't change our mind and then go forth into the world and act differently. We have to practice acting differently first, and then our confidence catches up. It's kind of like the same relationship with mood and activity. We often feel like we have to wait until we're motivated or until we feel like doing something before we do it. We have to wait till we feel like exercising before we exercise. But in fact, that reversing those is the much better way to go, to sit down and to do it, or to lace up our shoes and go to the gym. And once we're there, then often our mood catches up and we're glad we did it. We get into the mood. It's the same thing with action and confidence. So I would challenge folks to do things that they're a little bit scared of.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting, that situation you describe, where you get clients that want to figure everything out with you in the room and then go out to the world, because it almost sounds a bit like it's that same perfectionism talking of, you know, I need fixing, like as if it's binary, like right now I'm imperfect. If I'm perfect, then I'll be ready and then I can go live my life. But actually, you're living your life either way. So the thing to focus on is being gradually better, these little increments.
Exactly. And what people inevitably realize is that they've been walking kind of this social tightrope. They've been being very, very careful and restricted. And I've had this realization, you know, again and again over the years, and that think we're walking this tightrope, and that if we slip, we'll be humiliated or revealed or rejected. But in fact, we have such a wide berth that the range of just human behaviors that are tolerated and accepted and celebrated is so wide, and that we didn't have to be so careful and so restricted after all. But that can only be noticed in hindsight. I've discovered that we have to go through that realization. Somebody could have told me that and said, you know, you don't have to be so careful about what you do and say. It's really okay. You can relax a little. Somebody could have said that to me all day long, and I wouldn't have believed it until I experienced it. And so that I call that the moment, and because you can only see it in hindsight. You have this moment where you're like, hey, I never would have asked the waiter for another napkin before. I never would have sent back this coffee order that I didn't want. Like, I never would have said, you know, actually, I ordered decaf. I never would have showed up to this party without thinking about topics to talk about first. I never would have showed up for, you know, a job interview without losing a week of sleep. And so that moment happens over and over and over again and is so rewarding.
Absolutely. And it's incredible, I think, particularly with anxiety, how many situations like that people go through and they don't realize they can be without them, that there's so many things that they can frame as being them, where to outsiders are completely optional traits to, you know, to someone like myself. Something I learned not so long ago was that people with social anxiety, when they go to a party, they can often try and avoid the center of the room. They don't want to be center of attention, so they'll stick more closely to the edge of the room and not want to be sort of in the thick of it in the same way. And it never even occurred to me that people would do that. I would have never even thought of that. And I imagine a lot of people, even those that are going through it, don't actually realize they're doing those things until they move past some of them.
Absolutely. And I think it's important to say that even amongst folks who do have social anxiety, that one person's, you know, little safety behaviors or the things they do to try to keep themselves safe may be completely different than another's. And so while it all, you know, has the same kind of flavor, the way that it manifests might be very different. But one thing that I've discovered, that there does seem to be this package deal of positive traits that also hangs together with social anxiety. Folks with social anxiety tend to be highly empathetic. They are very caring. They are very pro-social. They're very conscientious. That perfectionism reeled back can make people be responsible and dutiful and really reliable and the kind of friend and colleague that you really want to have. So I always like to make that point.
Yeah, I really love that. I think that's a great positive point to finish up on, because I think that's quite universal with many forms of mental illness. There are many traits that when you have more control and when you've maybe had the support you need can be so positive in your life and can give you so much empathy and other skills like this. So we are running out of time, but we'll move on to your book. So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So it's called How to Be Yourself, Quiet Your Inner Critic and Rise Above Social Anxiety. And it's titled as such because often when people are nervous, like before a date or a job interview or the first day of school, well-meaning supporters will say, just be yourself. Mm-hmm. That's all you have to do. And that advice can be so maddening because it's, in a way, it's as if the person didn't know that. Like, it's, there's this sense of, oh, is that it? Gee, thanks a lot. But at the same time, it is good advice that you are sufficient, you are enough, and that it's simply being able to do that is the work. And so in the book, I talk about many of the things that we talked about, turning one's attention inside out, giving oneself structure, dialing back the perfectionism, and other tools for being able to do exactly that, to be the self you are without the negative parts of social anxiety. And it's gotten a really nice reception. It's already in its second printing. It seems to really be helping people, which is the goal. So
brilliant.
It's a dream come true for me.
And I've not yet finished it myself, but I'm really enjoying what I've got through so far. And also,
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, for sure. The other thing maybe to mention is your podcast as well, because I also listen to and enjoy that.
Oh, fantastic. Yes. So the podcast is called Savvy Psychologist, and it is a short weekly podcast that aims to be very actionable over a variety of mental health and well-being topics. And I take requests from listeners, which inevitably end up being the best episodes.
There's so many topics. It very much seems like whatever you're going through, there'll be one you've done specifically for that. Brilliant. Okay, so we'll finish up there. Thank you so much for being part of the show. And I hope people will go now and read your book and listen to your podcast for more about you.
Thank you so much. It was a delight to talk to you.
Thank you. If you haven't already heard, we've started a petition. to make mental health education mandatory in all schools. If this is something that you're passionate about too, and you'd consider signing such a petition or even just reading about it to learn more, you can find it by visiting bit.ly/mentalpetition. The link for this is also in the description. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.